Hello and welcome to another episode of the Leaders Sport Business Podcast, the podcast about leaders in sport from Leaders in Sport. My name is James Emmett, and with me as ever is my great colleague David Cushnan. David, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, James. How are you?
Do you know what? I'm deluxe at the moment. Thank you. Yeah, I'm feeling good, feeling positive, energised and ready to go.
Fresh off a long weekend?
Yeah, Easter weekend. And actually, I watched some sport over the weekend, David. You'll be surprised to learn.
What did you watch?
I watched, have you seen this performance from Ilya Malinin, the 19-year-old figure skater at the World Figure Skating Championships in Montreal?
I've seen a very brief clip, but tell me more.
Absolutely stunning. One of the most captivating, compelling bits of sport I've seen for years. Just an extraordinary performance. So this is essentially it's a dance, isn't it, figure skating, to the Succession theme tune. It's very dramatic, but this guy is a 19-year-old. He's probably the most technically exceptional skater that there has ever been. The jumps and spins he was doing. He's the second person ever to land 6 quadruple jumps in a single program. I think he was the first to do it with a quad axel. That's a 4-time spinny spin.
Yeah.
Honestly, spine tingling stuff. I urge you to check it out.
I will check it out. Mm. Are you saying that mostly because you like Succession and you like the music?
I just like really exceptional bits of sport, I think. And you should too. So have a look.
I will.
Yeah.
I will.
Can I tell you about what I was up to last week? Why I didn't see you for much of it?
Yes, you were out and about.
Yes. I was seeing various...
Dining with the recruiter, no doubt.
Do you know what? I was actually. Yeah, I had lunch with the recruiter. Yes, I had lunch with a recruiter. It was a very nice lunch. And actually, lots of tidbits of information exchanged. And fantastic news for all of you with leadership ambitions. In the UK sports industry, at least, this trend that we're seeing for US ownership, at least, in football, and increasingly US executive talent, particularly in commercial jobs, is leading to significant uplifts in salaries this year. So there is being the UK at the very top level, according to... the recruitment world, is coming in line a little bit more with the US, which means huge boosts to salaries. So an exciting time if you're in and around that level.
Well,
David.
Yeah. No, good. And nice to hear that you have got a regular diary of lunches.
Yeah, well, I also went for a coffee with Ed Warner, former chairman of British Athletics. He's also a serial board member across sport.
And he also writes, genuinely...
I think the best.
I agree with you. Yeah. The best and certainly the most consistently interesting and surprising sports industry newsletter.
Yes. Its chief concern is governance issues, I would say, and how sport is organised, particularly with a kind of UK focus, but he does look outside. But it really is an exceptional newsletter. And I think it is one of the only ones. And obviously, we operate in this kind of media landscape. And we read a lot of newsletters, though. And I would say that this is the only one that I can think of that is written from a genuine insider's view and happy to take a view and always a reasonable and well-argued view. Nevertheless, a view, and he's not scared of kind of throwing ideas under the bus, at least, if not people. But yeah, a lovely man, Ed Warner. I don't think I've met him before. It was really nice to meet him. It was a cappuccino he had, David.
And what did you have?
I had a black Americano.
Yeah, standard.
And he's talking about sort of being provocative in the equestrian and skiing worlds. And yeah, it's interesting meeting these people who are always in and around Olympic sport. I do, I find they're preoccupied. I mean, I don't wish to be patronizing, but I do find that what Olympic sports tend to be preoccupied with quite a lot, ultimately it comes down to funding, but it's sweet. I find it sort of sweet. The, you know, that sport, Corinthian sport, sort of exists like that. Anyway, what have you been up to?
Oh, not much.
Okay.
Well, I see I've actually had a... Go on.
You've got a snazzy cardigan on,
yes.
And I think you're doing it... you must be doing this for a reason, David.
I'm
the most fashionable item I've ever seen you wear, and we have got Julia Zucchini on later.
I'm dressing up for our guest.
You're dressing up for our guest, and I think, and I hope that she notices. Julia is the... She works for the ESL Face It Esports group. She's Commercial Partnerships Strategy Director, but importantly for today's conversation, she is a sneaker culture expert. She's the founder of this group called the Sneaker Sisterhood, which is a large community of women who are interested in sneakers. And yeah, she'll be coming in a bit later to talk to us about what exactly sneaker culture is, because it escapes
us. Because it baffles us.
It completely baffles
frankly.
Us.
Frankly. But before that, James, shall we run through a few of the sports industry headlines?
Yes, that's right, David. We are going to check out these headlines now. You turn this way and I'll turn that way. And together, we've got the full 360 covered. This is 180 Seconds of Sports Biz.
Liberty Media, the owner of Formula One, has confirmed its acquisition of Dorna, the promoter of MotoGP. The deal for 86% of the business values the motorcycle racing organisation at €4.2 billion. Dorna also operates the Moto2 and Moto3 championships and the World Superbikes Championship. Dorna CEO Carmelo Ezpeleta, who's run the organisation since 1994, will remain as CEO, but previous majority owner Bridgepoint Capital is exiting. Liberty Media's president Greg Maffei says he's very confident the deal will pass all regulatory and competition law hurdles.
Meanwhile, Clark County has reported that the economic impact of last November's Las Vegas Grand Prix was some $1.5 billion, with $884 million of that coming from visitor spending. Race weekend visitors spent an average of $4,100, excluding race tickets, with $77 million returned in taxes. The race, which required significant construction work around the strip, which drew the ire of many locals, generated around 7,000 jobs. F1, which promoted the race itself, spent $88 million on public infrastructure improvements, not including land acquisition and construction of its new permanent pit complex.
The Premier League has signed a four-year partnership with virtual reality software developer Rezzle. The UK firm, headed by Andy Etches, will work with the Premier League to develop a VR game. Meanwhile, on the other side of the Atlantic, ESPN has signed a major partnership with COSM, which will bring much of its live sports rights to live within COSM's dedicated 8K-plus enabled shared reality venues.
Dutch club Ajax has suspended its CEO Alex Kroos with immediate effect amid suspicions he was involved in insider trading. It's alleged Kroos bought over 17,000 shares in the club a week before his appointment was announced last August.
Elevate has acquired Fenway Sport Management's consulting group. The value of the deal was not announced, but Fenway's nine-person division will now be folded into Elevate Brand, which was launched in 2021 and is headed by Cameron Wagner. The combined offering will service over 20 brands at launch, including Fenway clients such as Santander, Monster.com and Moderna.
And an intriguing sponsorship deal from the National Women's Soccer League. Expansion franchise Bay FC, which has just begun its first season, has confirmed Sixth Street as a founding kit sponsor. Investment firm Sixth Street is already the lead investor in Bay FC, last year committing $125 million to help create the team. And that was 180 Seconds of Sports Biz. Just a little post-production editing note at this point. This is the point of the show at which we brought our guest Julia Zucchini in and introduced her and talked to her. But unfortunately, we had a small technical malfunction, which means that we miss about 10 minutes of Julia. So what I'm going to do now is do a brief introduction of her and hope that the editing work smooths out the first 10 minutes of this discussion. She comes in to discuss Sneaker Sisterhood, which is a group that she co-founded in 2019, which pretty much does exactly what it says on the tin. It's a forum for women who love sneakers. But Julia is the Commercial Partnership Strategy Director at ESL Face It Group, the esports organization. She's worked particularly in brand collaborations at that organization. She is active across the sports space. She's been a freelance presenter and host at various basketball competitions for FIBA. She's on the ED&I committee at Basketball England. She worked with David, in fact, at Nielsen, where she was a football account manager. She moved to Formula One, where she was a commercial business intelligence executive for 3 years. She's done all sorts. So hopefully we can have an edited version of the next 10 minutes, and then we'll be into the meat of the conversation with Julia Zucchini.
James, there are a couple of stories that we've just mentioned in the 180 seconds of Sportsbiz, which I will say was pretty much bang on in terms of timing this week. Mm-hmm. And where do you want to start?
Well, David, I hesitate to say the word interested, but I certainly am waiting for your view on the news that Liberty Media, the owner of Formula One, is looking to, or thinks it has got a deal to add MotoGP to the group. It's worth saying that you and I, before you spent 18 months working with Julia, worked at Sports Pro and Business F1 magazine for some time. And well, when I say some time, I'm going to say about 8 years. And this was a topic of conversation a ridiculously large amount of times. You know, when will MotoGP just bite the bullet and roll into the Formula One group? And it looks like it's finally happening.
Yeah, it looks like it's finally happening. So the deal has been done. Liberty Media acquiring Dorna, which is the promotional company that oversees and runs MotoGP, but also the World Superbikes Championship, as well as Moto2 and Moto3. So all the top international motorcycle racing will all be part of the same group as F1 now. So as we said, Liberty Media has acquired 86% of Dorna, which is based, a Spanish organization based in Madrid. All the management will remain the same for now, but a move that will almost certainly catch the eye of the regulators. There's still a couple of hurdles to be jumped. And it's interesting to note, because you are right when you say this has been a long time at least being speculated about. But there was, of course, a period in 2006 when CVC, Capital Partners, acquired a majority share in Formula One at a time when they owned Dorna. And they chose at that time to divest themselves of Dorna ownership because there were some serious doubts, was the phrase used at the time, raised by the European Commission about effective competition with the two organisations under the same ownership. So it remains to be seen how this will play out when it comes to particularly EU regulation. It's worth saying, though, as we said in the 180 seconds, that Liberty Media are very confident that they will get this through the various bodies involved. And if they do, we have the prospect of quite a lot of the world's biggest motorsport championships all under a single owner.
A few layman's questions, if I may.
Yep. What is MotoGP?
Well, it's motorbike racing, isn't it? Yeah. Right. It seems to me that MotoGP and Formula One are better and bigger apart. If they were together, I think the temptation would be to save costs by sharing venues, sharing race weekends, etc., which would, in my view, diminish MotoGP, probably. And I imagine motorcycle fans like the small twisty circuits that only motorbikes can do, and you'd have fewer of those. Is it worth €4.2 billion? What about MotoGP is worth 4.2 billion euros? Is it culturally relevant in the same way that Formula One is? Should we start with that?
What was question one again? So question one, Liberty Media have been very clear. This was announced yesterday, Monday. But they've already been very clear that the businesses will be run as separately as they can be. So any deals, and I think that's potentially to get around any regulatory challenges that may come. I think it's very unlikely that they will share race weekends, simply because of the way that circuits are configured for four wheels and two wheels. It's possible, though, because they do race on a number of the same circuits, albeit at different points during the year. Is it worth 4.2 billion euros? I mean, up for discussion. Certainly what Liberty Media are looking at is a big commercial upside here. There's already an existing race in the United States. MotoGP has had several races per season in the United States in the not too distant past. So there is a reasonable, it's reasonably established in the US, but certainly hasn't broken through. Yeah. And I think Liberty Media will certainly be using the playbook that they use.
The box-to-box playbook.
Yeah, for F1, in terms of raising the profile of the sport in America. I suspect they'll also be looking at raising the profile of the sport in the UK as well. It's been a long time since Britain has had a really competitive MotoGP rider, and although there's a Grand Prix every year at Silverstone, it certainly doesn't really make too much of a dent in the UK sporting consciousness. You know, big on the continent, or certainly bigger on the continent, but I'm not sure. I mean, if Pecco Bagnaia walked in here, James, would you recognise him?
I've got no idea. And actually, David, I have to say, and apologies to the many very good people working at MotoGP, I've got even less interest. And that is, and I can't be the only one, that's a difficulty that needs to be overcome.
It is, but I think Liberty Media will be looking at the fact that at its best, it provides some of the most spectacular close racing in the world, two wheels or four wheels. And so there's definite potential. There's, you know, the thrills and spills aspect to MotoGP is potentially high.
Actually, it's worth pointing out that there is obviously Liberty Media, a big North American finance house, and there is a key US link at MotoGP now in Dan Rossomondo, who's been the chief commercial officer for just over a year, sort of poached from the NBA, one of the senior guys at the NBA, a really coup of a hire for MotoGP around a year ago, but no doubt he would have played a role for a soft landing for Liberty there, perhaps.
Perhaps, and it's worth saying, as we mentioned in the news section, Carmelo Ezpeleta will remain as the CEO of Dorna,
Carmelo.
Well, I was just going to say he is getting on a bit. He was he's been in that role since 1994, and I think there is an element there of, as you say, there's an age issue there, but also there's probably a transitional phase into a new C-suite team at MotoGP in the not too distant future, in much the same way as when Bernie Ecclestone sold Formula One to Liberty Media. He remained in charge for a while, but was then moved aside as new American leadership came in at that point in the form of Chase Carey. So one to watch there, a big old deal. We won't see too many bigger deals this year, I don't think.
Perhaps not. Premier League has gone into partnership with Rezl. We know the guys at Rezl. They were on stage at Leaders a couple of years ago, I think. Not last year, but the year before. And they brought Thierry Henry along to kind of explain the nuts and bolts of the Rezl product. Thierry Henry is an investor in Rezl. And my abiding memory of the whole thing was how great Thierry Henry smelled, which perhaps wasn't the intended effect of having him on stage, but nevertheless, scent is a real powerful thing.
Indeed, my abiding memory of that day was Thierry Henry deciding a few minutes before his session, he was in the speaker room, surrounded by frankly, a bunch of leaders, people who didn't really need to be minding him that closely, and, you know, his own hangers-on. And he announced that he needed to go to the gents. And so everybody walked the 3 or 4 yards outside the door of the speaker room to the door of the gents, and sort of waited in a semicircle for him to...
As I opened the door from the inside and welcomed him in. Come on. No, anyway.
A memorable day.
Anyway, Rezl has gone into partnership with the Premier League to launch this new virtual reality game, which I think is interesting in that it's a very high-profile partnership. Obviously, the Premier League, one of the top dogs in terms of global reach. Really interesting that this sort of this idea of gamification, virtual reality is turning, you know, it's getting realer and realer, isn't it? I spoke to Alex Willis at the Premier League not too long ago, who talked about sort of looking ahead to next year and the rollout of a suite of new digital products for the Premier League, including a couple of very exciting gamification elements. I imagine this was probably one of them. Another one was the big changes to the Fantasy Premier League game, one of which has already been announced. But yeah, an interesting one, this one.
Yeah, Rezl, based in Manchester, they have been around for a few years developing this, and actually developing it out in two ways. One, as you say, the gamification side of things, but there's also a performance, a genuine sort of performance aid tool that this software can be for professional football clubs, and a number of them already use it. Interesting to see how this develops, as you say, as part of this bigger gamification play for the Premier League. And it links to the other deal that we mentioned, which is COSM, which is this company, this US company, that is building purpose-built venues designed for this idea of shared reality, where you get all the feeling and the emotion of watching something, being part of something, experiencing something with a group of, you know, a large group of people, but at the same time, it's absolutely making use of the best in technology. So
these are just massive screens, though, right? The COSM stuff.
They're big screens, yeah.
Huge, huge. They're all enveloping screens.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably downplaying it a bit just to call them big screens. But,
I don't know, David.
Is it like a sphere vibe?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So it's,
which is very impressive, mm-hmm. And completely,
it's designed to be best of both worlds. And COSM is certainly an organization. This ESPN deal is obviously a huge moment for the brand, and I guess brand awareness. But I think COSM is one to watch in the coming years in terms of moving out beyond the US into international waters.
Will you be able to smell Thierry Henry?
Do you know what? I think it was last year I wrote a report on, actually it was linked to our event in New York, the Force event, about sports, entertainment, lifestyle and culture. And I wrote a report about experiences and nostalgia, and how as marketers are getting more sophisticated in how they think about nostalgia and how they incorporate nostalgic elements into design and the experience and whatnot. And significant scientific study has gone into how memory works and how nostalgia actually works, you know, how it's activated in us. And it seems that scent is by far and away the most powerful activator of memory. Which is, I find really weird. Like, if you think about how you remember things, don't know, like, how are you, if you remember a time in your life, you probably think you're remembering it in words, right? You're explaining a story to yourself in words. But actually, it's a kaleidoscope of different senses coming together, and you're trying to pinpoint them. But yes, smell apparently is the most powerful driver of memory.
And what was your example?
Thierry Henry and the urinals at Leaders.
No.
I can't remember.
You
what
had
was
a
my
specific dumbness? Example involving Swindon Town.
Oh, yeah, the smell of, like, freshly cut grass and pies, and actually, I think, a bit of urine in there.
Sure. You see, mine were, because you asked me.
Bacon sandwiches at Silverstone.
No, the potent mix of bacon sandwiches and aviation fuel at Silverstone. Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, scent is a big, powerful driver. One final thing before we get onto sneaker culture, because we want to talk to you about sneaker culture, Julia. There's this news that Elevate has acquired Fenway Sports Management's consulting group. So this is an element of Fenway Sports Management, just a 9-person team. I think this, well, first of all, it's another piece of acquisitive action from Elevate, and they've been on something of a spending spree of late.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Come on, then.
What is Elevate right now?
Well, Elevate is one of these many, well, growing groups of commercial agencies with many, many strings to its bow. And that, I think, is the trend. You are seeing consolidation in the agency space as a handful of giants emerge and get bigger by adding new services. So they're all going to be peddling a kind of 360-degree approach to whatever with their clients. And you're seeing a few of them in the market on a spending spree at the moment, including Endeavor, WME, IMG, however you refer to that one, Elevate, CAA, and Wasserman. I would say that those are the four big ones in sport at the moment who are making a lot of moves.
The new big four.
Are they the new big four? I'm sure we're missing some out there, David.
Perhaps, yeah.
Do you know what? There is room, though, the counter side of this trend. There's always a counter side of a trend. The room here is for specialist independent agencies, I think, to double down on that independence and, you know, make a USP of it. And so I think we're particularly seeing this in the recruitment space. And I was just thinking about a nice lunch I had the other day. And
he's always
in other specialist areas. Anyway, let's move on. Should we talk about sneaker culture?
Let's do that.
It's great that we've got you here for that. No, sneaker culture, Julia. It's increasingly obvious to me and David, who I'm going to say, I'm speak for you, Dave, not necessarily the most.
No, please.
We're not individually that fashionable, I don't think.
No, although I think I've never been more fashionable today. I've really made an effort today.
You have, yeah. And I know.
Do you like the cardigan?
There you
Thank
go.
Thank you. That's
there,
what I was waiting
there,
for.
You, there you go. It's becoming increasingly apparent to us as we program this annual event that we have in New York, Force, the Sports Entertainment Lifestyle Culture Media Brands Show, basically the crossover of all of these different areas that's having cultural impact. It's becoming increasingly apparent to us that sneaker culture is at the center of so many of these crossovers. It's where fashion collides with sport. It's where music collides with fashion. Like your shoes and your sneakers, how you wear them, how you buy them, how you think about them says so much about you in this sort of cultural era that we are living in. And fair to say, David, that you and I are completely not part of that sneaker culture.
But we're keen to find out more.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. You talked about sneaker sisterhood. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I thought that was, and this is naive, I thought that was more of a sort of group where you could meet up and talk about sneakers.
That's definitely part of it, and
right.
That's how it started.
Like a book group.
Yeah, not necessarily like physically meet up and talk about them, but we used to have like a clubhouse when that was a thing during COVID.
Yeah.
But it all started because to buy sneakers, limited edition sneakers, you have to enter raffles.
Yeah.
With different retailers. When you win those raffles, there's then usually one or two collection days, but they will always do like a big collection day, and we used to meet outside of Selfridges to pick up, and then you would see familiar faces. You would see 5 women that would turn into 10 women that would turn into 40, and we kind of just built the community off the back of that. But
yeah.
We were definitely meeting up and talking about sneakers. Yeah.
Okay, well, that wasn't far away. What, in your view, Julia, what is sneaker culture? If you were going to define it yourself right now, how would you define sneaker culture?
It's hard because I'm in it, and for me it's all encompassing. Like everything that I do,
it's just fashion.
It's sneaker culture, and like you said, it touches sort of every element of my life. Like if I'm listening to a song, it might reference some shoes that I have, and it's also interconnected. But I think it's one of the main ways that not always individuality, but self-expression has come about. So I'd say it's self-expression.
Mm-hmm. You were with us in New York last year, actually, for the Force event out there, and you moderated an amazing session about sneaker culture and about brand collaboration in the sneaker world. Chris Davis, the CMO of New Balance, was with you, and Natalie White, founder, chief executive of Moolah Kicks, the sort of female basketball specialist brand, and quite a new entrant into the sneaker world. She was great. I thought such amazing enthusiasm. But can you remember much of that session? Can you give us a flavor of what you learned there?
Yeah, I feel like they both talked about quite different things because of the different aspects that they cover in their respective worlds. But I mean, I loved what Natalie was saying all around finding your niche and really focusing on that. Obviously, she's focusing on women in basketball that had never really been done before, so creating something very specific for them. But then moving on to Chris and New Balance, I think what he said around brand stagnating was really important. And I think we see that quite a lot in the sneaker world. I mean, fashion is pretty cyclical. It comes back around. And I think some brands, more than others, are guilty of just sort of reveling when their brand is cool and it's working, and then they don't do much to innovate or much to maybe tap into that nostalgia or tap into what are the general trends. And obviously then they go back out of style, and then they won't come back for the next 10 years. And obviously for investors or anyone else, that's a bit worrying. But I think everything that he said around constant innovation, but also again, staying true to your brand, staying true to your authentic values, and also working with influencers or personalities that resonate with your brand, not doing it because everyone else is working with that person. I think he spoke about New Balance working with Jack Harlow and the fact that they picked him when he wasn't the Jack Harlow that we know now. He was just, you know, a little white kid rapping, but he was cool, and he made sense with New Balance. And, you know, they stick to those people, and they then follow their success and are able to then work with that as well.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, the kind of brand transformation that New Balance has gone on over the last sort of 7 or 8 years. And, you know, fashion is cyclical. Things go in and out of trend. But if you are the most senior marketer at a brand, it is your job to make sure that they are going into trend and not coming out of it. But New Balance especially, you can just see, like, if you just take a cursory glance around people's feet anywhere, you know, in a cultural centre in London on the tube, you see so many more people wearing New Balance now than you would have done even 2 years ago. So clearly they're back in. So whatever the strategy is working. And you're right to mention partnerships. They've taken a really strategic approach to partnerships. They're clearly not one of the, they're not the biggest one, New Balance, right? Nike, Adidas, they're the behemoths. They're going to be spending the most money on partnerships. New Balance have had to take a challenger approach to how they do partnerships. And I watched the session back the other day. Chris is really, really articulate on how these partnerships work. And he says that there's three buckets. They think about partnerships in three different ways. There's global sports partnerships, there's cultural and entertainment and fashion partnerships, and then there's streetwear, high fashion, branded collaborations. Those are three very different things for them. And they've got different kind of spending, different budgets for each one and different sets of objectives, but they go about them in the same way. They're always co-authored. They're always from the approach that this is a challenger brand, this is a challenger partnership, this is how it's going to work. Can you remember how many? So bear in mind, we're talking about this being not the biggest one. This is a relatively small punching up kind of organization. You remember how many global sports partnerships New Balance have? Chris mentioned it.
In terms of even with organizations,
yeah,
or
so
just
this is,
with athletes?
This is teams and individuals. So it's everything from Bukayo Saka they had Liverpool a few years ago, didn't they?
God, that's hard.
I can't remember if it was surprisingly high or surprisingly low.
I just focus on basketball usually in my brain, and I feel like they do represent like quite a few basketball athletes now, a lot of college students now with all the nil deals as well.
Is it 300?
It's 500 plus. 500.
Yeah.
Wow. 500 plus.
500 plus. And another so you asked them about purpose in partnership. And a thing that I remember from that session is Chris explaining how an individual partnership would work. So they've got several different touches. So they give them They obviously give them a fee, but then they give them product and they give them cash to give away. So you have to give back. So every New Balance athlete has to go and spend money on community, charity work, which I think is an amazing way of, you know, you talk about values-led partnerships. It's an amazing way to make sure that's happening if you give them everything they need to make sure that they're following your kind of values. But yeah, it was an amazing session. And brand collaborations were a big part of it. Obviously, at ESL Face It, you specifically are working in brand collaborations. You've got some big ones under your belt now. How from a sports rights holder perspective, how do you go about putting together a fashion brand collaboration? What are you thinking about? What are you trying to achieve?
Definitely more of a sports angle. In esports, sometimes it gets a little bit tricky just based on the product that we work with and first-person shooter games and how brand safe that is in our conversations. But I think in general, what I would always make sure that I'm talking to a brand about is obviously the reason why collaborations happen is usually to expand that core audience that you're targeting. So obviously you don't want to go to something that overlaps completely. I always like to talk about it as a Venn diagram. You obviously want your audience, their audience, and then you want some overlap because you want the brands to resonate. You want to have similar values. You want to be able to do storytelling that is authentic and resonates with both sides, but you also want to bring something new and fresh and be able to innovate. So I think those are probably the key elements that I would always discuss. And then in terms of the product that you want to focus on within that, it usually depends on the brand that you're working with and what flexibility you have there. But I think always the most important thing that I always talk about if we are discussing product brand partnerships is you need to give your collaborator some freedom and some creativity, because when you don't do that, I think they tend to fall flat and neither audience is then happy.
What about your own sneaker journey, Julia? Where and how did it begin? And I guess, when did you start thinking about the phrase sneaker culture?
So I started liking sneakers as a kid. Mostly my dad played professional basketball, and then I was playing professional basketball in Italy, and he would always show me all of his Converse collection. Still can't believe he played in Chuck 70s. My knees could never. So started wearing a lot of Chucks. Then I don't know if you guys are familiar with a brand called And One.
I'm not. Yeah. You're nodding, James.
Yeah, it's a basketball brand.
Okay.
So And One was like the first real like street basketball brand. And they used to release mixtapes, and they had athletes that would do just the coolest tricks. And in continental Europe, those were the only sneakers that I could get in women's size. So I started buying these And One Tai Chis, ended up with like all the colorways. And I didn't even know that was considered being a sneakerhead, but it was my introduction to the sneaker world. And then it sort of grew from there when I moved to university in the UK. Met lots of other sneakerheads. It was always through a basketball lens, though. It was always basketball shoes. And then it kind of grew from there.
I'm really interested in this concept of this limited edition element, which is obviously a tried and tested marketing tool in pretty much any sector, but seems to be absolutely sort of fundamental in this world. How do you know, you're somebody in it who lives and breathes it. How does that concept of scarcity play into sneaker culture and how it plays out?
I think it probably depends from types of sneakerheads. I think there's a lot of different types of sneakerheads. And I think
we're about to do some segmentation.
Yeah, I feel like there's a whole audience segmentation piece there. And I think also my age has played a big part. So Julia, 8 years ago, was all about getting the most hyped limited edition sneakers. Now it's just, what do I like and does it look good? And am I actually missing it in my 200 pair collection because I have too many shoes and now I'm a bit more selective with what I buy?
Is the next phase of that comfort?
Embarrassingly enough, yeah. I do go a lot for comfort
now. You
should
check out New Balances, actually.
Yeah, I actually have uncomfortable amount of 990s and 991s. But they're actually comfortable.
They
just an uncomfortable amount, comfortable shoes. So yeah, I think scarcity always does play a role, but interestingly enough, I think now there's been a little bit of a shift where they're saying that brands that have played too much on that are now slightly less successful because people are bored about not being able to get their hands on the product that they want. And then other brands have tried to sort of counteract the limited edition. People are sick and tired of not getting products, so we're going to flood the market, and then people no longer want it because it's not cool anymore because everybody has it. So I think it's a very delicate balance and quite a hard one to strike.
Shall I give you some numbers, some sneaker industry numbers? Yes,
please.
Yes,
absolutely.
Right, so this is from Statista. Obviously, you've compiled some statistics from here, there, and everywhere. And they say that in 2024, global sneaker revenue generation worldwide will be $80.19 billion. And it's expected that this market will experience annual growth of 5.18%. For the next 4 years. Comparing the revenue, putting this into perspective, the revenue generated per person in 2024 is $10.35. I've spent a bit more than that probably on sneakers.
Yeah. I think average sneaker price has also increased. I used to buy Jordans for $120 and now my Jordans cost about $220.
Yeah.
Which is very upsetting.
Huge market, though. And I guess a newish element to this. So obviously, there is, globally, countries with growing middle classes who are interested in more, ultimately trivial things like how many pairs of sneakers they can get, which is fueling this growth. But also there's been this shift after COVID, right, of what you can wear in a work environment. And suddenly there are far more opportunities for far more people to care about wearing sneakers rather than, work shoes, just bog standard pair of work shoes. So I guess that will be absolutely fueling growth at the moment.
So here's a layman's question, Julia. What makes a shoe hot or not? What are some of the key criteria?
I think it's definitely the scarcity side of things. Oftentimes it's who the collaborator is. So for example, if it's Travis Scott and he's like the hottest rapper at the minute, that will make it a lot more interesting. The shoe model is usually, brand first. Obviously, I think if Travis Scott had collaborated with Merrell, maybe it wouldn't have been as successful. But obviously, being Nike, that was the hottest brand at the time, Jordan, that worked. But then also the model that you collaborate on. So for example, when he did Jordan 1 Lows, very successful. He then did a Jordan 36. And I don't think they sold many of those, even though it was Travis Scott. So shoe model will matter. And then also time of year and specific, let's say, celebrations that might lead to importance of certain collaborations. So for example, Kevin Durant always does like an Aunt Pearl variation of his shoe. That's very sought after. People want that specific item. So that's quite important as well.
You said you've got sort of over 200 pairs at home, but you and the way that you look at sneakers has changed over time. When you walk around in a pair of shoes, what do you want other people? Do you care about what other people think? You want people to look at your shoes, right? And what do you want them to go, ooh, I wonder what those are? Or do you want them to go, I know exactly what those are and I love them and I wish I had them myself?
Yeah, we have this weird thing in the sneaker world that we call the nod.
Right.
So like if somebody knows, they'll like look at your shoes and they'll like give you a nod so know that they know. So it's a mix of that. And then I also just enjoy people coming over and being like, oh, these are awesome. What are they? And then maybe I can tell them.
Yeah.
The one thing that I do really dislike is when people come to me and they're like, oh my God, I got the same ones at JD Sport. And I'm like,
so scarcity is.
It's like, absolutely, you do not have the same ones. You do not.
The reverse nod.
Yeah, I was like, don't say that.
Do you sell them? Do you sell any of your collection?
So there are pairs that I will never, ever sell, no matter how destroyed they are. Mm-hmm. Like the other day, I've got a pair of Jordan 11 Space Jams from 2009, and they are disgusting, but they will forever stay in my collection. Mm-hmm. But there are others that I've sold because I gave into the hype and I bought them and then realized that I didn't actually like them, and other things that I think fashion is cyclical. Mm-hmm. It's no longer really my aesthetic, so I'll mm-hmm. part ways.
So always keep the boxes, right?
I do keep all my boxes.
Yeah, you've got to keep the boxes. Always keep the boxes, David.
Okay.
Yeah.
another top tip. Go on.
No, I was just going to do the fun question.
Go on.
You're going to do the fun question?
No, this is your question.
Yeah. I hope you've thought about this, Julia. But basically, we'd like to play a little game where you anthropomorphize the main sneaker brands, and if you had to give them all a personality characteristics, which personality characteristics would you give them? Should we start with Nike?
Yeah, also disclaimer, can nobody get upset about what I say about these? I wear all these brands, so I'm a bit of everything. I think Nike would be your more like typical jock. That's maybe like they don't really know why they're cool, but they're cool and they just do it and own it, and they're obviously really good at sports.
Natural confidence.
Yeah, natural confidence. They've always had it from birth. They just came out and they were like, this is me.
I'd say they used to do athletics at school and then went through puberty and decided it got really big and started playing basketball.
That's very specific. Yeah. You've been thinking about this as well. Yeah.
Adidas
for me is the more nerdy person that really like loves nostalgia. They love old school football boots and all of that, and they will wear shoes that make no sense for that specific activity, mm-hmm. but they'll always just wear it because they think it looks good. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a bit more nerdy, a bit more like grandpa-ish vibes.
Grandpa.
Kind of like my upper half too.
Oh, okay. And you're wearing a Carhartt cardigan.
Yeah, collaboration with Awake New York.
Okay, very good. Asics, do they have a personality?
Yeah. Probably a Japanese kid.
Yes.
That likes anime. I don't know. That's probably really stereotypical and awful.
Yeah, maybe.
It's interesting, Julie, because I've got the question written down here, but I haven't got the list of brands that James is reading out. I'm intrigued to know how long this list is.
I'm just remembering them. New Balance.
New Balance, you know what? I don't know if you remember, they did that amazing advert a couple of years ago and it was like worn by models in London and dads in Ohio.
Yeah.
So it could really go
so good
either way. So I think it could be like a dad in Ohio that's just mowing the lawn in some beat up pair of New Balance. Yeah. Or it could be like the hottest girl in London, Paris, LA, Milan.
Yeah.
Sounds like they've got the market covered.
Yeah, I feel like they really diversify their
Chris Davis
persona.
Genius. is it cool to have really esoteric sneaker brands? And when I say esoteric, like maybe you're wearing a pretty Chinese brand outside of China where they don't sell them. Is that cool?
I think for people that are really knowledgeable in the sneaker market and have very specific niche interests, it probably is cool. Would I say that is what will serve the masses and get Gen Z excited when they're running around Soho to unlock a golden ticket to win a Cortez Nike shoe? Mm-hmm. Probably not. Mm-hmm. I think it will work for certain groups.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just have spent some time with Dwayne Wade in China and I really like his line, but I think it's only available in China and I'm really preoccupied with being cool. So hey,
yeah, I think the problem with some of the athletes is that not everyone has been able to do a Michael Jordan where a basketball shoe has turned into a lifestyle shoe. Even LeBron, mm-hmm. I know very few people that would wear LeBrons for lifestyle and I'd probably judge them if they did.
Yeah.
So I think it's very difficult to have that crossover.
And full credit to you, Julia, for just ignoring that absolute clang of a name drop from James.
I'm a bit jealous though.
So you're not necessarily prepped for this, but what's the best bit of media you think you've seen that's about sneaker culture? For people who want to sort of understand a bit more about the space and want it to be entertained in the meantime, is there anything that you would point to as like, this is just absolutely amazing for, even if it's just for, right, heat on feet, as you might, you might say?
So I really, and I can't believe I still watch it because it's been years, but there's a Complex show called Sneaker Shopping, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with. Joe LaPuma is the host. and he'll have all sorts of celebrities and people come through, and they just get to go shopping in whatever store they've picked for sneakers, limited releases and so on. But they always give a bit more context in terms of what the shoes are, why they're cool, why they're hip, why they're this, why they're that. So I think it's a really, A, it's a great way to find out about stores that you should go to if you want sneakers. B, you get to see what celebrities like and wear. And then you get to see very cool pairs of sneakers that sometimes, you know, if they go to Flight Club, you'll see sneakers that you'd never be able to get your hands on unless you're willing to drop $10,000 on them. So yeah.
That's not the darts place, is it, Flight Club?
No.
should we finish there?
Same name, different store.
What a good place to finish. I think we've been shown up. Julia, a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for bringing us into your world just a little bit. And we'll get shopping, James.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So convincing.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks for having me.